Dr. Sara Al-Madani said, narcissists rape your soul every single day. They're monsters in human flesh. Do you agree with that?
Dude, I mean, I think some people experience it that way when they're on the wrong side of a real bad relationship,
yeah,
or being in a cult or something. So I will not say people don't have that experience. I generally feel calling people monsters isn't a good way to understand them. And just my general understanding of evil and evil people in general throughout my career is that when you talk to somebody who's evil, they very rarely say, "Hi, I'm a monster and I'm evil and I'm here to hurt you." It's much, the world is much more complicated than that.
Do you think evil exists then in people from your experience?
You know, there's this idea floating around that's a little bit, I won't say fringe, but it's just hard to really nail down sort of with the behavioral genetics, which is this idea of the bad seed. I mean, there's a book, and that book by this, and I chatted with the author because she wrote it about someone in her family that they're just like, where did this evil person come from? So there is this concept around sometimes you get some pretty bad people. And certainly in psychology, we know that traits like narcissism, but especially psychopathy. In the narcissism world, sometimes we talk about malignant narcissism, which is like narcissism plus power seeking plus a little sadism. Yeah, you get some pretty nasty people out there for sure. You get some pretty nasty people. But again, evil... Yeah, maybe I'm getting a little C.S. Lewis because I'm talking to somebody from the old country, but evil is often a little more subtle and a little more seductive than just the monstrous presentation you see with some of these more extreme forms of psychopathology. Narcissism can be really bad, but when we talk about extreme psychopathy or, like I said, more malignant narcissism, that's a little bit, typically a little worse.
And why do people get attracted to narcissists even when the mask drops and they show their true colors?
Well, they don't get attracted to them when the mask is dropped. They get attracted to the mask usually. So one of the things that makes, it gets a little complicated with narcissism because there's this more extroverted or grandiose form that a lot of us are thinking about when we think about narcissism. And then there's a more vulnerable form, which isn't that appealing. But with the more grandiose form, you have somebody who's extroverted, confident, maybe charismatic, socially assertive, and energetic. So you have a whole bunch of positive traits. And then you have some other traits like self-centered, sense of entitlement, willing to manipulate other people to get what they want, game playing. I think they're better than everybody else. So you get some negative stuff, and narcissism is very much a trade-off between those positive and negatives. The way relationships work, well, I don't know. I guess they don't work anymore with your generation. I'm sorry. I don't know what the heck they did, you guys, and I apologize because I wanted nothing to do with these evil SOBs. That's what I think is evil, is having young kids not have fun. I think that when you first meet somebody dating, what you see is the more extroverted, sort of the mask, the persona, the charm, the confidence, the charisma, and that's really appealing. Once you get to know somebody, the mask slips, but usually at that point you've gotten talked into a relationship and then you start making excuses for it. I mean, it's like you take a cruise, you save up all your money to take a cruise to the Bahamas or something, and you go, "My God, I'm seasick and the food's bad and it's just kind of hideous." But you spend all this money and you go, "Well, it's pretty good still and I'll make it work." So I think the problem is people get sucked into it. And you'll see it with politicians. Your politics are different than ours. Ours are much longer and they're more reality television. So you'll see it with politicians. The more you see them, the more the mask will slip. You'll see them in odd positions and you'll see anger and hostility, real antagonism through their eyes. That I'm thinking of a few people right now whose masks are slipping. It's interesting.
Yeah.
But it usually takes time with narcissism to see it.
Yeah. Well, for the grandiose narcissists, does it always take that long to notice it? Because maybe they're not narcissists, but I sometimes, from the traits that you've just described, I've often come across a few people here and there where I'm kind of just like instantly like, okay, there's something slightly off of you. You're slightly a bit.
Yeah. So I think two things. One is, sure, you can notice it in people. And secondly, you're going to notice it when the narcissistic individual isn't paying attention to you. But if they're paying attention to you and they're sort of charming and charismatic, like I have literally never met a politician I didn't like. Well, I'll tell you, one I met, I was like, dude, this guy is such a phony. I can't even stand it. But even then, at least he was trying to be a phony. So, I mean, that's kind of how it is. The people are charming if they're good at the job. So usually if somebody's narcissistic and they're talking to you and they want to form a relationship with you because they see some value there, they're going to be maybe perhaps charming, or they might inflate your sense of esteem. They might say, oh, you're special. Sometimes in the romantic relationships, they talk about it as love bombing. The data on that are kind of iffy, but I've heard it enough with people. So narcissists can sometimes activate that same ego and narcissism in you. And you, God, I really like this person. They're so energetic and they seem sort of attractive and they think I'm attractive and I really like them and it's great. And your friends might watch this and go, dude, this bad red flag, but you're not going to see it. I mean, if some attractive narcissistic woman came up to you and started being charming and telling you you look good, you'd probably fall for it. No offense to you. I would probably fall for it in 2 seconds. And I've been married for 25 years and I know better. So it's very easy. If somebody wants you to feel good about yourself, it's very easy to let them.
Yeah. And do we fall for it neurochemically, do you think? Is there some like neurochemistry going on here where like oxytocin increase, dopamine increase?
I tell you, I just don't know enough about neuroscience and neurochemistry to say anything that isn't just using it as a metaphor. So, you know, I could even say mirror neurons if I wanted with your lifts there. I don't know. My guess on the personality trait side with the narcissism, it's the extroversion that's really driving the attraction. So people who seem energized, confident, extroverted are attractive. We like them as leaders, but I don't know what the neurochemistry is or if there is, something that crudely neurochemical under it. It could be for sure.
And how would you define the difference between someone having narcissistic traits and then someone having clinical narcissistic personality disorder?
Yeah. So narcissism it gets real confusing because we have this term narcissism, or we'll say narcissist, and we're talking about either somebody who's a high level of these personality traits that have to do with narcissism, or they have a clinical disorder. Same way we say, yeah, my buddy's depressed, or my buddy's got major depressive disorder and we're putting him into a 72-hour hold in a psychiatric facility because he's suicidal. I mean, those are two very different things.
Yeah.
And narcissism's the same. So the narcissistic personality disorder is defined as having, let's see, a very positive view of oneself, a lack of empathy in close relationships, and a need or desire for admiration. So it's essentially saying, I'm awesome. I don't really care so much about other people, and I need to do things interpersonally to keep myself feeling awesome, like be admired by people. And then the definition, and this is from the DSM-5, it's the same in the 4 actually, goes through 9 things. It says, if you have 5 of 9 of these that are clinically impairing, it can be narcissistic. And they're things like, you know, only want to hang out with special people or institutions, need admiration, want to be center of attention, those kind of things. The key is a psychiatrist or somebody doing an assessment needs to show that each of those narcissistic traits leads to significant clinical impairment, or to be clinically significant impairment in an important domain of life. For example, my ego is so big, I can't keep a marriage together. I'm so overconfident, I take risks at work, and I lost my job at the bank. I have mood, emotion regulation problems. When people tell me I don't get special treatment, that I become dysregulated and enraged, and sometimes assault people verbally because of my sense of entitlement. And so if you get a bunch of stuff like that, a clinician goes, well, that's a disorder, let's treat it. But it has to have impairment. And if you're just kind of an arrogant jerk, but you're doing okay, that's not a disorder, that's just your personality.
So it has to deeply affect, especially social relationships, right?
Yeah, well, the way we tend to break it down with problems is love and work. You know, does it affect you at work, or does it affect your relationships? That goes back to Freud. And the problems themselves are, with narcissism, it's primarily going to see interpersonal problems, like your marriage falls apart, but you're going to see some affect or emotion regulation problems. Like I said, if you get rejected or negative feedback, you're not going to handle it well. You're going to maybe see some distortions. I mean, you're not going to see delusional systems like I'm the king of an unknown universe, like a schizophrenic. But you're going to say, like, you know, I'm a big deal, when you're really not. So you're going to get a range of problems, but it's not going to be extreme. It's something like schizophrenia or something. And the other thing with a narcissistic personality disorder is it's supposed to be part of your personality or your character. So it should be around a long time. So if your buddy wakes up one day and becomes, you know, you're like, dude, you're acting like, you know, super narcissistic, what's going on? It just happened. You wouldn't look at NPD. You'd say, like, well, is the guy doing, you know, meth? did he have some sort of, you know, mold issue? Is there something, maybe he's having a manic break and he's in a bipolar phase or something? So there's these different manifestations that might look like narcissism, but if they just happen in one day, you wouldn't think it's personality. You'd think it's something else.
That leads me to a question that is, does it have to appear in childhood, or does it have to just be, it can pop up in your 20s and then be consistent for the rest of your life? Is it the consistency, not the time at which it appears?
For something to be a personality disorder, it has to be around in adolescence. With children, when we're talking to, you know, a five-year-old or something, we can predict adult narcissism from temperament in young kids.
Wow.
Now, when I say predict, I'm talking like 8% of the variance, or, you know, for a psychologist saying prediction, what it means theoretically is different than a normal person. Like, yeah, I'm not betting a whole bunch of money on it. Like, I see a pattern, but it's not one-to-one at all. Yeah. You can predict it, but typically young kids, they go through developmental phases where they're self-centered, where they're exhibitionistic, where they're attention seeking. You know, the joke is you see kids dancing around naked. No one goes, oh, that kid's got NPD, let's get a shrink. We go, that's a normal part of development. Everybody laughs.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you sort of lose that over time. So Freud talked about narcissism as, you know, maybe a healthy phase of development, or at least a normal phase of development. And I, you know, it's not something I worry about with young kids, because kids change a lot, even though there is some consistency.
And you've touched on it briefly, but what is dangerous or malignant narcissism, and how is it different from the other types? And I've read that it's starting to increase. Is that correct?
I don't think anyone knows if malignant narcissism is increasing or not. I really don't know, because it depends. Well, it depends on how you measure it and where you're putting a line. If it's if there's a bright line of, if you're talking about like almost a clinical like condition. So there's not a real good measure that we use, like, hey, this is the malignant narcissism measure. There might be one floating around that I haven't seen, but not one that's really common. The idea comes out of more psychoanalytic literature, psychodynamic literature. I think the most recent review was by Kernberg, but I get Kernberg and Coet mixed up, and I apologize to both of them because they are both much more important thinkers than I am. But I think it was Otto Kernberg wrote the last review I read on it, which wasn't that long ago. Malignant narcissism is, imagine you're self-centered, you think you're a big deal. You also are a little paranoid, like, do people really think I'm a big deal? They're out to get me. There's also a big power component to it. I want to have power over people. I want to control people. And then, of course, with the word malignant, which comes from the root bad, it usually has a lot of hostility associated with it. So malignant narcissism is what you'll see in sort of a really nasty cult leader or political leader, or just a really abusive, an abusive husband. And there can be women too. I'm sorry, I keep using male models for this. There is there's more male narcissism than female at the extremes. But again, it's almost like a combination of narcissism and psychopathy with a little more, well, it's like narcissism, psychopathy with a dash of paranoia in it as well, and domineering, sort of some domineering traits. So it's just kind of nasty.
Yeah. And what are the fundamental differences between psychopathy and narcissism?
So it can get complicated because just like there's multiple measures of narcissism, there's multiple measures of psychopathy. But typically when we say somebody's a psychopath, there's a little lower self-control. So people who are psychopathic are a little more impulsive, maybe a little more neurotic, maybe a little less socially confident. But still, I mean, what the sort of the core variable across, you know, when they talk about like the dark triad or dark tetrad, a lot of times people talk about these models. The core variable there is a sense of antagonism, low agreeableness, self-centeredness, sense of entitlement, sense of superiority, a sense of callousness about hurting others, being interpersonally mean. So that is the core. And if you take that and say somebody like that, who's also sort of impulsive and doesn't have a lot of self-control and a little unstable, that's more psychopathy. And somebody like that with some higher self-control and more extroversion is going to be narcissism.
Mm.
So they're very similar. It's just narcissism's going to work better in our society because you have extroversion and a little higher self-control. When you go to prisons, you're going to see a lot more psychopathy, or what we might define as antisocial personality disorder, which is very similar to psychopathy. We'll see a lot of that in prisons because these are people who couldn't pull it off.
Mm.
When we go to the city of London and we visit the statue of Mithras and we start walking the streets, we're going to see a lot of grandiose narcissism. And those are people who have higher self-control, higher confidence, and they can pull it off and be very effective. Mm. I'm trying to make references for your audience to relate to.
Well, no, we've got quite a big US audience as well. I think it's like 20%. Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so don't worry too much. So the fundamental difference between a psychopath and a narcissist is empathy not there? Like, are they both...
They both have lower levels of empathy. But then the question with empathy gets complicated because people go, well, you're narcissistic, you lack empathy. You're a psychopath, you lack empathy. Somebody says, dude, how do you manipulate people if you can't empathize with them? You're not a robot. You can understand people. You can mimic empathy. You just might not feel that sort of emotional sense of compassion or empathy, but you have that perspective taking or cognitive empathy.
Mm.
And that's what gets scary. So what you'll sometimes notice with people that are a little psychopathic, this isn't my area, so So our academics were like real specialized, you know, like, you know, I really know ants, but termites, man, whole different world.
Wait, hold that thought. I'm genuinely so grateful that you've stuck around with us to listen to these fascinating insights from the guest so far. If this episode has given you one piece of knowledge which has helped you understand yourself and the world a little bit better than before, the absolute best way to support us is to pay it forward and hit the share button right now. Don't let this knowledge stay hidden. Please send it to one person who will benefit from this episode. Thank you so much. Let's dive back into the rest of the episode.
You'll see with psychopaths, they kind of practice empathy. You'll see this, and you'll see it in the movies. I imagine that American Psycho, which I never saw, there must have been a scene of him practicing empathy. It's kind of a common trope. So they'll understand it and they'll mimic it and practice it so that it's the emotional empathy isn't there so much, or the compassion, but there is that perspective taking, which makes people really dangerous. There's been some therapeutic ideas like, hey, if we take people that are sort of narcissistic or psychopathic and teach them social skills, they'll make friends and then they'll be happy and well-adjusted. And what happens sometimes is they become better predators.
Wow.
Like, imagine if you and I are like, yeah, we get World War III and it goes kinetic instead of cold. And you and I are living up in the highlands hunting whatever ducks. We're going to dress up as sheep so we can get close and kill those ducks. And that's what psychopaths do. You hide yourself so you get close and then you can predate on things. It's very predatory.
Yeah. And I know you haven't watched American Psycho, but from what you're saying, it almost sounds like Patrick Bateman, the main character from American Psycho, is more narcissistic than psychopathic because he's such an extrovert. He seems like a grandiose narcissist.
Yeah,
right?
And I might have read it. I read Less Than Zero. I can't even remember. That was a great book. It was like my childhood in California. When you see really high functioning psychopaths, they're very similar to narcissists because they have that high level of self-control. There's a scene that they always show from that movie where they're comparing note cards. It's like and that is a really narcissistic scene, right? Because it's all about you're better than me. You have higher social status than me because you've got the ivory ecru and I've got the this. But what you'll notice in that, which is good you're bringing up about narcissism, is one, that scene is about narcissism, not psychopathy. It's about status seeking. And two is he feels absolute rage. He feels what they call narcissistic rage. He's acting so well because you can just sense. I mean, like, it's not even like he's acting. But it's internalized because he won't let himself break self-control because he's a banker and he's in a suit and he has this very controlled body language and stuff. So that high level of control sounds like narcissism more than psychopathy.
Definitely.
And sometimes they'll make shows where the character starts out as a narcissist and then kind of devolves into, like, House of Cards, which was an American political show. I think they might have had a British version too, but I don't know. With Kevin Spacey, he started out playing this really kind of Machiavellian narcissistic character that was really interesting and then sort of devolved into more of a psychopath over time.
Is that realistic? Is that actually, does that happen in real life?
I mean, I'm sure it does, but I think the idea of a high functioning, highly controlled psychopath is really scary. It's like somebody that can pretend to be normal for 5 years and then just go murder something. Like, that is really frightening. I don't think it exists in the world as much as it exists in our imagination, because most of the data, when you start looking at people who are psychopathic or even people who claim to be Machiavellian, meaning they're manipulative and cunning and smart and conniving, they're kind of impulsive and a little dumb. So sometimes people are telling themselves a story about how sneaky and they are, but they're not. There's a And when people have tried to look for the master criminal or the high IQ criminal, they don't really find it in the literature. It's not that they don't exist. They probably run the world.
Yeah, that's so smart.
But there's not that many of them. Like mostly, if you're self-centered, you're mostly going to be impulsive because you're going to take advantage of people. And a lot of the reasons that grown men and women don't do bad things is because they care about other people. Like I've got a family. I can't do dumb stuff. I can't do selfish stuff. I've got people who depend on me. Everybody in my family is in the same boat. My wife has everyone depend on. My kids, that we depend on them. My kids are like, I don't want to embarrass my dad. And so if you have relationships, it keeps you in check.
Yes.
But if you fundamentally don't care about people or you don't care that much, then you can get out of, you can do what you want. Now imagine you're going to be a political leader. What happens is you get destroyed in the press and they attack your family and destroy your family. So by definition, you have to be willing to throw your family under the bus if you want to go into a leadership role. They often will say, I had a conversation with my family and they support me. And I know sometimes that's the case. I mean, it is, I should say it is the case. I know politicians with loving families, but it's not always the case.
Yeah. And why are these top celebrities and powerful people that we see in the media and that, you know, run the world, why are they often displaying narcissistic and psychopathic traits? Are they always being selected for that?
Yeah. So there's a few things. There's self-selection, meaning if someone says, hey, you want to run the world, you're like, yeah, if I got an ego, that sounds good. Believe me, I have an ego. If somebody gave me the keys to the kingdom, like, Keith, you want to give this a test run? I'd do it in a second. Like, I've got that big ego. I hopefully wouldn't be evil, but I would love to drive the car. So you need an ego. The other thing you need is you need to be able to be good at rising in leadership. And the traits that make good people good at rising at leadership are social confidence and assertiveness. And that's one half of narcissism. The other trait that really comes out in the research on political leaders is manipulativeness. You need to be able to manipulate. That's politics. I mean, politics is literally just, it's the art of the deal. It's the art of manipulating people to do this, and they're manipulating. It's like the big dance. You got to be good at that, which takes a certain kind of people. The third ingredient, and this is where it gets a little bit dicier, is people have to let you into power. And a lot of times what it seems to me is they don't let you in unless you're corrupt. Because if you're not corrupt, you're going to upset the apple cart for everybody else. So in the United States, we have an odd phenomenon where people go into public service and they've got $500,000 and then pretty soon they've got a net worth of $20 million and no one really knows exactly how that happens. And well, part of what they're doing is insider stock trading, which is legal in the U.S. So yeah, figure that one out. So what happens is there's a selection for corruptibility in politics. I mean, I look at the European leaders and I can't imagine a more disgusting, corrupt, just, I mean, there's not, no offense to your continent, because you can say the same about ours. I can't see one person I respect in any position of leadership in Europe. And I can think of maybe two exceptions, but I won't say them because it will upset half your audience. Maybe one, maybe two, horrible people. Just the worst, disgusting, corrupt, dumb. And so how do people like that get in power? You know, I don't know. And then you always go, how come people get in power and they don't do the good thing? And they just, you just can't because the system. I mean, it's just the nature of systems. You could say the same about academia too.
Is that a expression of human nature, if it's the system of the world almost?
So humans are built to have dominance hierarchies and reverse dominance hierarchies. So we have a system where people can rise up and build and control a big dominant system. But when people do that, there's a natural system of humans trying to cut that person down. You see this in like Scandinavia, I think they call it the law of junta or something. I forget the name, the law of something. And in Australia, they talk about tall poppy syndrome.
Yeah, yeah.
I think in the UK a little, they'll talk tall poppy.
Yeah.
But that's a reverse dominance hierarchy. You don't want anybody being too kind of arrogant or put themselves above each other. So I think, and this is my argument that's based on a gentleman, an anthropologist named Christopher Boehm, who wrote a great book, Hierarchy in the Rainforest. So I'm not making this up myself. But I think humans are pretty, we're not a super dominant creature like great apes or chimpanzees. We're a little more balanced. It can get out of hand where one person gets power and then puts a ring around him to guard him, and he can generate a lot of power in an empire. But they don't last a long time. They get taken out. That's just, so you see this cycle of power in the world. And if you look at traditional hunter-gatherer societies, there's often much more egalitarian social structures. Mm-hmm. Everybody's pretty similar. Maybe there's a headman, maybe there's a shaman. Other than that, they're pretty egalitarian, a little more knights of the round table, you know, a little more like the old England before the, you know, the change. So I think we have this natural tension in our system, but in a modern world where you can accrue power, look at the game. It's how do you accrue power and keep power? Mm-hmm. And that's the game everybody's playing around the world in democracies or whatever we call our republics. I don't know what you guys call yourself. It's a harder game to stay in power. So they're trying to rig the systems so they, you know, so they'll get in power. Well, I won't even, they'll do things to rig the system so they don't ever lose power. Or power trading between two people who are really the same people behind it. You go to Russia, you go to China, Turkey, they solve the power problem by just becoming, I don't know what the right word would be, more autocratic systems.
Yeah.
El Salvador is going that way now. They just changed the re-election laws. And I just watched the president give a speech about urinating in public, and we're going to become more Singapore. So you're seeing a lot of those more authoritarian leaders emerging right now as the world destabilizes. And unfortunately, they're probably going to do better than the democratic leaders because they'll just keep people will. I mean, they'll just keep people will like in U.S., people will just keep fighting each other, and then they're going to do to us what they're going to do to us.
1930s round two, then?
I hope not. It sure feels that way. I say about 1/10 of what I think. that's my plan. But my sense is, we've been in a cold World War III for a while now, and a lot of this is sort of, I don't know if it'd be fifth generation, a lot of psychological warfare has been going on last 5-10 years. And it's very hard for normal people to see psychological warfare. I only notice it because I know what our limits are for ethical stuff, and I know when it's broken. So I think we're in a very strange psychological climate, and a lot of what's war now doesn't feel like kinetic war used to in World War II, except what's going on in the front right now to the east of you, probably. Is that 1,000 miles, 700 miles? How far are you guys?
Well, Ukraine.
Yeah.
More than that. Quite a lot. Yeah, it's quite a few thousand.
Okay, that is an old school World War One hell. That is hell. That is a hot war, and the rest of us are still in a war. It's just a psychological war,
Do you have any examples of the psychological mechanisms that they're using?
Oh, I mean, it's So it's propaganda. I mean, that's what a lot of the, you know, war boils down to, is just propaganda. And you just, and they're using bots and they're using social media to shape narratives. And they've been doing this. And the problem is all the countries are doing it now. The first talk I had with somebody at DARPA about, DARPA is our Defense Advanced Research Program in the U.S. So this is kind of, these guys are running 25 years out in terms of their science. The first call I had with DARPA was after the Arab Spring, when they talked about weaponizing social media. I forget the date of that, but it's been going on since then. So in Arab Spring, they figured out social media is a weapon. It's basically a weapon. I mean, it's a weapon. Mm-hmm. And so it's being weaponized by all these different people. I don't understand why. I don't have any clearance. And when people tell you they know the truth, they don't. Because when you ask people who really know what's going on, if they tell you, they go to jail, like a bad federal prison for a long time. So no one will tell you anything who knows anything. So when people tell you stuff, that's usually not true. So it's very hard to know anything.
Wow.
Yeah. And social media, big cities are making narcissists and psychopaths, I guess, less accountable in terms of human nature. If you were in a small tribe, right? You'd be kicked out of the tribe. So is that a danger of social media and these large metropolitan towns?
It's complicated. So urbanization, what happens with urbanization looks like you get more individualization, higher narcissism. At least these are data out of China. I've seen it. I haven't seen it in the West, but that'd be my guess. Because you go to an urban environment, you don't have those social controls. You can invent yourself, reinvent yourself. You don't have a bunch of people saying he's not like that. It also attracts status. So it's going to be more of an attractor. The other thing with urban environments, when people live in dense apartment blocks, they don't form families. Mm-hmm. They don't get married. They don't have kids. You see this throughout East Asia now. So South Korea, people are moving to Seoul, birth rates have collapsed. People move to Tokyo and Japan, birth rates have collapsed. China, birth rates have collapsed in the coastal provinces. You end up with a lot more atomization, a bunch of single people running around. And when you have single people running around without like tribal affiliations, meaning affiliations, they're just prey. Mm-hmm. And so you just get a bunch of people to prey on them. You get narcissists, mm-hmm. you get psychopaths, you get charlatans and hucksters. And I mean, of course you do, because that it's just like you set up an environment for it. Mm. Like the modern urban environment. It's funny. I talked to a classicist once. It was an expert, you know, Roman Greece. And she said, you know, cities are just where people go to die. And I'd never thought about it that way. That's the history, is people in the country, they lose money, they go to the city, they can't survive. I go back to Victorian England, the Industrial Revolution. You know, people go to London, they're dying. It's a horror show. You look at China when they industrialize, it's a horror show. So I think these cities are doing a lot of things. It's not just the cities, it's that kind of high density urban living, basically turning people into zoo animals. It is not healthy for anything. People aren't having kids anymore and we're dying off.
It's almost selling your soul, isn't it? If you, in that analogy, even if you don't die nowadays by going to a city, it's like you could be seen as...
You know, I won't say that. I won't say that because my daughter's living in New York City. It just moved there and I got to support her. But there's a fear there. So what you're saying is I'm seeking ambition. And when I'm seeking ambition, I'm not staying back at my hometown. I'm not trying to marry the local, you know, the local fire chief or something and have a bunch of kids. I'm seeking my fortune. Mm-hmm. And so there's some narcissism there. There's some ego there. Now, I have nothing but love and support for a young man or woman going to the city to seek their fortune. It's a beautiful thing. It makes me tear up. The problem is if you get trapped and you start, you know, that becomes your life. And there's a lot of appeal being young and status and success focused. When you get to be my age, dude, you just like you care about your dogs. It's like, I mean, you're like, God, I love my dogs. I had some great times, but you care about your kids, care about your family. I talked to a lot of people. It's useful to have friends that are 20 years older, I think, because it helps you plot a course. Mm-hmm. When I talk to people that are, 70s, 80s, they care about their kids, their families, and their dogs. And that's really, it's a very limited thing. They're not really career focused. People usually have a career, usually about my age, really even late 40s, 50s, people are more interested in generativity. If they're healthy, like what I can do for the next generation, how I can lift them up. So I think ambition isn't necessarily bad. I think it can be a trap.
Yeah. Yeah. And do you think the older generations have that mindset because they physically don't actually have time to care about maybe the more superficial things, and they're just trying to do stuff that intrinsically fulfill them, like caring for their kids, caring for their dogs and their immediate surroundings?
I think it's partly, one of it is you don't have any time for anything else. You know, God, when you have young kids, it's just like, it's all encompassing. So I think that's part of it. But I also think like status is empty and fame is empty. And I say this as someone who's had enough of it that I got to see what it was like. It's like saying I'm going to go all in on cocaine because that's really the best I feel is when I'm doing a few lines of cocaine. So that's going to be kind of my focus. Like it's not sustaining. And so, because it's never enough. It's like, it's like you can never really get enough social status or power. I mean, but you can easily get enough love. Like I love my wife and kids. I don't want to have another family. I'm not like Jacob. It's so great having a family. I'm going to get five of them, because you're like, no one wants that. You're like, I'm fulfilled.
Yeah.
It's harder to get that with fame seeking. And fame doesn't pay it very well anymore. It used to pay, but fame doesn't even pay. So you get a lot of downsides without upsides for people. And oh my goodness, I was out in Hollywood doing some one of these kind of things, but in person out there, and just chatting with people. And I like to chat with people, and everybody I chatted with was an actor. The guy driving me, the limo guy, the guy, the bartender.
Wow.
And I've talked to people who've studied acting, the celebrity stuff, and it's a really hard job. There's very few people working at any time. It's really expensive to keep up the celebrity lifestyle appearance. It's just a horrible career. Like my daughter's like, I want to go to be a celebrity. Be like, yeah, I'd probably consider accounting, shoot some YouTube on the side. So yeah, I think a lot of that and sort of motivational psychology, we call those extrinsic values, fame, fortune, status. They're all important. Fame, fortune, and status I can use to benefit my kids, and they're great things. But they're not ultimately fulfilling. In the same way that love is, the spiritual connection with whatever is higher than you is, than flow states are, than doing what you're passionate about is, I'm rambling. Dude, you got me rambling doing your nodding, and my coffee's kicking in. I'll tell you what happened. I'll just keep it real. This is a time, another LA experience. I'm talking to somebody doing their show, and they said, what accomplishment are you most proud of in your life? I never had that question because I never really thought about it. And I thought, well, as the first guy to fly fish a couple rivers in Mongolia.
Pretty cool.
I was like, that's pretty fucking cool.
Yeah,
like,
that's pretty cool.
And I was like, yeah, that, you know, maybe one in South America too. But definitely a couple in Mongolia. And I felt pretty good about that. I was like, you know, I'm glad when I was young, I did some adventures. The other stuff, you know, that was just life. So I guess what I'm saying is I think people seeking that sort of high level fame and stuff, go for it, but just don't get too attached.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah. And it almost seems, again, I'm going to go down slight neurochemical route. It seems like these kind of extrinsic things like the fame, the status, that's the dopamine. And then, you know, fly fishing in Mongolia or having a family, that's the serotonin, the oxytocin, which is more fulfilling. I guess I'm not a dopamine expert. Don't get me wrong. But
that's the metaphor. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the metaphor, is one life is much more of a chase. It's much more of a seeking a rush. And dude, it's a rush. Mongolia was a rush too, but it was a little deeper than that.
Yeah. Yeah. And what's one surprising fact about narcissism that most people won't know?
Geez, this is a question I've never gotten before. I guess I don't know what people know that would say it's a surprise, would make it surprising. Let's think for a second. Okay. Here's something that might not be surprising. You see it more than it exists. So because people who are narcissistic are both good at self-promotion, interested in social media, interested in leadership, and interested in fame seeking, when you go online or go on the TV or go on the YouTube or whatever, what you're going to see is more narcissism than exists in the world. So you're going to make the assumption that the world is filled with narcissism. But when you go walk around the street and talk to people at the shops, you're not going to see the same amount of narcissism. So we think there's more of it than there is. And then the other thing is, in the celebrity world, there's such a pressure to self-promote that you can see people that you think are really narcissistic that are actually really lovely people underneath it all, but they're just playing a role.
Yeah.
And you go, they're really nice people. I really like that person. And you meet people that you go, oh, they seem like cool people. And then you go, oh, that guy's kind of full of himself. And so you get both of those kind of surprises in that world, but there are a lot. I'm not trying to say that anybody who's famous is narcissistic, because I mean, I talk to a lot of people who are famous and do podcasts, and a lot of really nice, interesting people. And I think in the podcast format, it's harder to be really psychopathic and hide it for a long time. People start to see it after a while, I think. I don't know that for sure. That's my sort of theory.
Well, you'd hope so. If you're posting, I guess, like two to three or even one 3-hour episode every week for, let's say, 10 years, like a Joe Rogan, you know, it's going to be hard to keep up that persona with that many different people.
Exactly. And and Joe Rogan does not come across as narcissistic at all. The only thing I would say about him is he comes across as like he could literally kill you if he wanted to, standing across the table. And so people are very honest on that show, and that doesn't come across. But when I watch the CNN guys go on there and start shaking, I know why. It's because they literally know they could be put in a cobra hold or something within 30 seconds. It's kind of funny.
Yeah, it creates a unique dynamic, I guess.
a very interesting dynamic that doesn't, I think that's one of his, he has a few superpowers that make him really good, and that's one of them, but I don't think he doesn't strike me as that narcissistic. Others do, but not, he doesn't.
Mm. Yeah. Well, have you been on Joe Rogan, right?
It's been a long time. I mean, it was during the pandemic.
Yeah. What was your experience like? I guess it wasn't.
Oh, it was great. He was I'd say he was a He's a real gentleman. I'm a freaking academic. I got zipped the offer him. He was a real gentleman. And his way of, he's the best in the game, because the way he sets up his studio with headphones is you can't really talk over each other. He thinks like a fighter instead of an academic. So you line up all the pieces like an academic, make an argument, and he'll see where a weakness is and he'll hit you from the left side. And that's not how academics work. So he, and this is very hard to see, but he's kind of looking for weakness. Mm-hmm. He picks up lies very well, or weakness in ideas. He just has a good sense of that. And then he's coming in from these different angles because he's a fighter. And then on top of that, I think it's the fact that physically he could kill you. And I'm pretty fit. I don't look it, but you know, I'm a yogi. I figured I could have lasted 30 seconds. he's a warrior. You know, yeah. I thought he was, I didn't know who the guy was. I just did a show. I thought he was a comedian. He's a warrior. And so, it's a very different energy. It's great. I'd love to do it again. It was such a rush. But that's why it's so good. There's a lot of tension in there that you just don't see. Mm. And you don't really see that in other shows as much. A lot of people try, but he has a good, yeah.
Yeah. He's top dog for a reason.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like, and it's a weird skill stack. And again, academics, we're really into like set up an argument, make it this, and we're real technical about crap. And then when someone just clears the whole chessboard, you're just like, it's fun. So, yeah. Mm,
yeah. Yeah. And on narcissism, how do you know if your partner's a narcissist? Because I was going through like the short form content, the TikToks, the Twitters, and when I search on narcissism, it's always relationship advice.
Yeah. So unfortunately, or fortunately, about 20 years ago, I studied narcissism. I bet I could make this a national conversation. And it sort of worked. Everyone talked about narcissism. The problem is that no one knew what the heck they were talking about. And what it got translated, narcissism got translated into sort of a generic term for a jerk ex-boyfriend I don't like, who doesn't care about my needs as much as his own needs. Mm. And then people started doing these things like, what are the 20 red flags for somebody's a narcissist or whatever? And I try to help people with that. It's the problem is that if you look at all the research, if you meet somebody who's grandiose narcissist, initially you're probably going to have a little bit of liking for them, especially if they're more extroverted. I always use the example of the Tiger King, but that's probably now dated. I don't know. I need another example. So they usually, and it's hard to know just from talking to them. If you're talking to somebody extroverted and confident, you're probably going to like them. So if I meet somebody I really like, I always go, that's a red flag. But I don't recommend that to people. What I try to do is to suggest to people to look at their history and to look at how they treat others that are lower than them on the status hierarchy. One thing we say in psychology is that the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior, meaning that people are consistent. That's the basis of personality psychology, is we have this consistency across time and situation that's a signature of our personality. That's why we're not interchangeable. We're just different people. So if you meet somebody and they have a history of bad relationships behind them, chances are you're going to be another one of those bad relationships behind them in the future. Just like if you see a tornado running through town and it takes out the three towns next to you, it's probably going to take out your town and not pick you up and take you to Oz and introduce you to the wizard. So look at resume and history and all that stuff. Look at how people treat people below them. If people are dismissive, if they're cruel, contemptuous to people below them on a dominance hierarchy, especially in our culture. It's just kind of a little bit of a red flag. I guess maybe in England, if you're upper class, you're allowed to be snotty to lower class. Does that still happen? I don't know. I'm sorry. I love those rich British guys are fun because they get pissed and they have those great accents and they're fun, but they're kind of soft and kind of douchey. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I enjoy them, but I guess it wouldn't always be fun. If you see a lot of that, and it's not culturally appropriate, again, if it's part of your culture, it's not diagnostic of a personality disorder, it's a cultural situation, but if it's not part of your culture and you see it. So that's usually what I look for, is the historical stuff, how they treat other people, other stuff, over attention to grooming, conversation goes back to themselves, high extroversion, center of attention. These are all really attractive things. You're not going to see the problem with dating into relationships. So sort of the way we do, we date and then we transition to marriage. It's like, let's go to a disco together. Then we're going to start a business together based on how well the disco goes. It's really stupid, but that's just how we do it. Dating is about energy and attraction and passion, and narcissism is really good for dating, and relationships is about conscientiousness and showing up on time and feeding your kids and making pancakes, and that does really well with low narcissism. So the problem is the selection mechanism is not selecting for what you want in a marriage. So you got to train yourself to say, look, I'm gonna settle for the person who doesn't seem as exciting, not the cokehead peacock guy that has the Lambo, even though that sounds really fun. I'm going to settle for somebody who seems like a stable person I'd want to start a bakery with, because running a family is basically running a bakery. You got to get up at dawn and start getting to work. I need the baker, but everything in society is telling me to like the other guy with the things. Our system is screwed. And the result is a bunch of people in their 40s who are going, what happened? And you're seeing this culturally with, especially women getting 35, 40, where they're like going, I wanted to have kids. I want to have a family. My biological clock is ticked. And that's really sad. At least women can make friends at 45 or 50.
Yeah.
When you see a 50-year-old guy and he's going, gee, I'm going to date a bunch of 20-year-olds, and the 20-year-olds look at you like, get away from me, granddad creep face. And then you run into some country in, the third world trying to find a girl who would go out with you because it's better than the alternative of starving. Like, it's hard to imagine a more pathetic way to go out. So there's a lot of focus on women ending up alone, but men ending up alone actually do worse, just because women they like each other. Maybe they're mean, but they form friendships. They make friends. They go out. And guys used to do that, but because of the cultural changes over the last 20 years, the pubs aren't filled with young men talking and sharing pints and having a good time. I don't know exactly what happened. I have theories. It's a whole nother conversation. So, I don't know what I'm talking about. You got me rambling, man. You hit me at the coffee time.
No. I understand everything you're saying. It's all good advice. And my fix for the pub thing is actually the sauna and the gym. So I found a lot of young friends from going to the sauna and the gym. And I guess maybe there's a shift in the health conscious individual stuff that's helped with that.
Let me ask you a question, because you're a young guy who goes to the sauna and gym. I went to church yesterday. I'm not always a churchgoer. I went to the Catholic church in our local town, and I saw 20 guys there. I'd say 20. Every one of them was fit. Like fit, and they were lifting weights, because you get that body type that when you're doing it with that kind of exercise, you get a certain look to you. And they all were fit and they were all going to church. And I thought, this is something I haven't seen. this is not how I grew up. I mean, when I grew up, everybody was like drinking and trying to meet girls. That was it. I don't know if that's a good thing because it seems really positive to me. But then I go, where are you going to meet a girl if you're at the gym all the time doing sauna?
Yeah.
You know, because all the guys were at church and the girls were at church, but they weren't together.
Really?
Yeah. So what do you think's going on?
I think there's a lot to it, I guess, but, you know, social media and seeing these bodies on Instagram, these like ripped jack guys, and also these health conscious people, these like the self-improvement niche is increasing, and alcohol's getting shit on more. And I think a lot of people go to the gym to try and increase their sexual market value, but then forget to do the talking to girls thing as well. It's like you end up this jacked, ripped Chad, but you don't have any charisma or like extra.
You're like the Fabergé egg, but you can't actually get a date because you don't have any social skills. Oh, yeah. God.
It happens a lot, man. Yeah.
And then why are people not, like, I quit drinking in 86 because I'm a maniac. Like, I had to earn not drinking. It wasn't like a choice. It was like I was a crazy man. But, like, people are not drinking for health reasons. Is that right?
Yeah. So, yeah, I think it is mainly for health reasons. Maybe it's also just, like, the previous generation, like my parents and grandparents' generations, especially in Britain, like, I've seen a lot of bad stuff come from drinking, and I've grown up in pubs and I love pubs, but I'll be sat there with my Coke, pint of Coke, rather than, you know, the drink, not the drug.
Yeah.
instead of a beer. And yeah, I think it's just a shift in culture, I guess, and preferences. But I think if you go to the gym and the sauna and then talk to not just girls, but also guys as well, instead of just doing it for yourself and maybe doing it in an almost narcissistic way and doing it in an extroverted way would be better.
I agree. And I think building any sort of social net, it's so hard right now because they want to shove everything. Like we're talking online, which is cool, like across continents is pretty cool. But like in real life, you want to talk to real people in a real conversation without 20 people listening in between.
Yeah.
And I think a gym is a great place to do that. Just as long as there's etiquette for it and stuff. I'm a yogi. I go to yoga. We chat before yoga class and that was same kind of thing. So it does help form some social networks, but it's not as clear as a pub. And also alcohol is a social lubricant. It makes people more comfortable talking to each other. There's a reason it exists culturally. And I sort of go, I mean, I have very mixed feelings about it. Alcohol is so dangerous, but at the same time, I don't have an answer. I hope things get better.
Definitely, yeah. It's definitely got worse since COVID, just for sure, as well.
Do you see any sign of improvement after COVID?
I mean, personally, yeah, but that's just like survivorship bias and availability bias. Personally, yeah. But then there's probably 90%, 99% of like people probably still either just sat in their room on social media all day or playing video games and stuff like that. You know, it's not good. I mean, a lot of people do go to the gym and then also do go to the pub as well. So I guess that's like a balance for people our age, but, I also go to university. So that's again, another selection effect. Maybe people who stay in the hometown. Fair off worse or better. I honestly don't know. But I mean, I think less people are going out.
Where do you go to university?
Cornwall, Southwest England. So I'm from Southeast. So it's about 6 hour distance between the two. But yeah,
Do you surf?
No, I don't surf. I should, but
you
I don't.
You should.
I know.
I'm going to meet girls out there, man. Don't they like surfers still?
Yeah, there's a lot of surfers down here. Yeah. I mean, the thing is with where I am in Falmouth, it's very self-improvement kind of yogi, you know, meditation. We're right on the ocean. There's saunas on the beach, you know, you can just walk down. It's quite a small town. So it kind of reminds me of California or my idea of California. So
it's, really?
Yeah. So it's more of, again, a selection effect, but everyone seems really nice down here. and sociable from the people I've met.
Well, that's not, and where do you live on the other side?
Canterbury.
Okay.
Yeah, so like an hour away from London, which, you know, it's not great. I mean, I love it. Like, I like growing up there, but it doesn't have the same vibe. People aren't as approachable. But maybe, again, it's that confidence thing. Like, when you leave your hometown, you, like we say, you reinvent yourself and you become
more
confident.
Yeah, yeah. And you're in your old town. You're like the young kid. You go somewhere else. You're kind of like a young Turk.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, my advisor's in Southampton, down that part of England. Canterbury's beautiful. That whole plain is just gorgeous. Mm. Just like mystical country. But I've never been out to the Falmouth, and I would just love to go out there sometime.
Oh, it's amazing. Do you surf?
Yes.
Yeah, you'd love.
Not
you'd
as
love
much as I'd like to. I was thinking if I were young, that's what I'd be doing.
Hmm.
Oh, yeah, if I were British, why don't you move to Australia?
Yeah, I could do. I mean, the tall poppy syndrome, though. It's like, no, I need to travel to Australia. I need to visit
it. Oh, so you're like, I remember talking to Chris Williamson, who's like one of these podcasters.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I was like, dude, you got to come to the U.S. You're just too ambitious for the old country.
Yeah.
And I think that's what happens with people that are ambitious. It's just, you don't really have the shot there that you do here. We like ambition.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's like a hero of mine. And I think I definitely want to try and go to the US before moving there. But I do have that in my mind of, ooh, you know, that'd be pretty cool to go there. Everyone seems a bit less cynical.
Yeah, maybe they are. I think people are going for it still. Like, people are still like, I mean, dude, you can't meet anybody more cynical than me, but it's not like I'm still going for it. Like, there's no plan B. There's no place to go. You know, we're kind of down here. And again, this is sort of the Southeast U.S. and Texas. And I mean, I guess it'd be South Texas and Florida and Georgia, Tennessee. It's a little different culturally than, like, we never locked down during the pandemic. Well, we for a couple of weeks, but it wasn't like it was everywhere else.
Mm.
Sorry, I'm getting way off topic
here. No, I love it. I love it. So is it more libertarian in the South?
I wouldn't say it's more Scotch-Irish, you know?
Yeah,
I mean, the country music, I mean, it's like Scotch-Irish and a lot of Midlands England. That hillbillies are all kind of Midland England. I think of it as just more like going to Scotland and Ireland than going to New England. So people, there's more music, there's more drinking, there's more fun, there's more fighting, there's more driving trucks. Everyone likes guns. They like to hunt and fish. We have some big cities, of course, but, I met this group and this family who has an Italian restaurant in London, and they love America. It's the funniest thing I'd ever seen, a London Italian restaurant in South Kent, or maybe it's just Kensington, where the guys were all there like, oh, we love America. They have these big belt buckles. They're telling me about driving Ford F-150 pickups and really fast and shooting guns. Like, kind of America. Yeah. So it's the South is a little more old America. Mm. The New England's a little more European, I think.
Yeah, I think on my radar, Austin, Texas would be pretty cool to live. California and New York, like LA and stuff, they just seem a bit too much for me.
LA is too expensive and it's crime filled and Texas is a kind of a zoo, but there's a lot going on. There's just so much going on down there. New York is great if you want to go into finance or certain industries. And New York is actually kind of a nice city. It doesn't seem like it would be from the views, but it's actually really, it's like a small, I mean, it feels like a lot of villages put together. So it's not as big as it seems. A little like London a little bit.
Yeah.
But come on over, man. Have some fun.
Definitely will. I'll definitely love to do a round two in person as well in America. That'd be awesome. The fact that you're describing yourself as the most cynical person, it's just it just shows the difference between like Americans and British, because I wouldn't have even thought you'd, from what you've been saying to me, you do not seem cynical at all. But maybe that's just because I'm comparing to the cynical British people I know.
Oh, you know, maybe the difference, I'll tell you, I have a buddy who has a car dealership. And he said when COVID came, he said, you know, we met with the main headquarters and our sales dropped 42% and the sales in Britain dropped 96%. And I said, what happened? He goes, I can't lose my business. I had to make it work. Mm-hmm. So we're like, we have to make, like, I don't, it's over, but it's death, but I still have to make it work. So yeah. I think there's this, just this kind of ambition underneath it that people like, you know, like when the pandemic hit, everyone just like, we're moving to Florida, we're moving to Georgia, we're just going to make it work. We're not going to, we're just going to keep moving. And the only problem is in the U.S., no one knows where to go. Like if there's nowhere, if we fall, I don't know where I haven't figured out where we go.
Mm.
So maybe this is it, because there's really no place left.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's almost that rational optimism in a way,
I think so. Cause I, like I said, I'm very cynical. I'm very anxious about a lot of things because I look at trends and I don't like the direction any of them are going. And I've been watching these trends for decades. And I'm with this trend that scares me the most is the lack of children and the lack of marriage and children. And my concern is that when you have a society dominated by adults, the society becomes childlike, because Disneyland says we need to market to adults, and the Lego company says we need to market to adults, and the toy companies market to adults, and we have more dogs than children.
Wow.
And then what happens is you get an indulgent, immature adult society of sort of adolescent adults who never really had to grow up that are being catered to.
Mm.
And then it's over, because they're incapable of making hard choices and they're soft. And I can be real cynical about things. Believe me, I can be cynical, but like, you just got to go for it.
Yeah. And when you were saying that stuff, I was just thinking to myself, church, is that one of the main things that's creating this divide almost?
Interesting. When we were studying religion, atheism spiked. And I'm forgetting if it was 2009 or 2011, somewhere around there. You saw it with college students as non-belief, maybe not atheism, maybe agnosticism.
Yeah.
It just boom, went in this huge spike up. And there was this neo-atheist movement. And I get that. I understand people, like, it's hard to believe religion the way they package it. You know, it's like, this seems kind of dumb. You're not selling me on it. That trend looks like maybe it's turning around. And so sometimes I think it's the Great Reset versus the Great Awakening. And that's what's going on right now. Sometimes I get more cynical about it. But I do see this trend back to church. And I think what people are realizing is there's a spiritual aspect to life that they got lied to and was told it didn't exist. And they were told that they were just robots that had needs. And I think people are waking up that story was a lie. and they don't know how to wake up. But that, when I look at the church data, people are going back to the Catholic or even the Eastern Orthodox churches. They're not really going Episcopal or Anglican because they got too woke. They're not going to really any of the mainstream denominations, sort of the non-Catholic denomination here, like Methodist or Lutheran. They're going to evangelicals. So sort of the church is here where they've got rock and roll and better music and everything. When I was walking through the streets of London recently, maybe not that recently, I was looking at all the beautiful old churches, and they have been converted often to evangelical churches. So I think that the spread is going towards evangelical or more traditional Catholicism, or because people want something authentic. They want to, like, the world seems so phony. They want to feel something real, and people are lost. And so they're, you know, and when you talk about going to the gym and sauna, that's physicality. That's like, the world is fucking insane. I got to touch the ground. Well, when I work out, I feel it. I feel I'm real. That's really me. When I sit in that sauna, I'm dying. That's really me. Okay, now I'm ground.
Yes.
I know where my ground is. Now I go act. And so people are saying, but there's a spiritual center too. No one told me about that. The church kind of manipulated me. Then they lied. Then I heard a bunch of atheists say only idiots go to church. And I went that way. And I started believing science because I didn't know any better. And I mean, dude, the only people who don't believe in science are scientists. You know, you're trying to find ground. You're trying to reground yourself into something bigger than yourself. And that should be your society, but they took your society away.
Yeah.
Like England, they just sorry, dude, I'm getting cynical here. England, to me, last time I was there, which a few months ago, I was like, my sister lives there, family. And I was like, this place is just, it's just a museum. I mean, it's literally feel like London is a museum. I met a few people from Britain there in a pub that were real nice to talk to them about philosophy. I'm like, your culture's dead. You're a museum.
Mm-hmm.
That's horrible. Britain is one of the greatest ancient societies on earth. Cambridge is older than like Machu Picchu, I imagine. But people don't know that because they've all been brainwashed. I mean, I did a deep history tour of your country. I was like, this, because it's my culture too. I mean, my family's been here for 400 years because you bastards kicked us out and stole our land. But still, I'm like, you're still my heritage. You know, I still respect, it's amazing the history of England. Even though I fucking hate it, it's amazing. And anyway, it breaks my heart to see what's happened to the UK, to see. And I go, where's the king? If I were king, it would be a very different world. But that's my cynicism. It's seen the world turned into a museum. Seeing people atomized, turned into robots, seeing them being distracted, fighting each other all the time. And I think what you're doing, which is going down and grounding and finding what is real and building a firm foundation in what is real, and physicality is the easiest way to access what is real. I think that's the way to do it. And then you build from physicality, then you build some relationships, you build your skills and competence, build some spirituality, and then all of a sudden you're in charge of yourself. You're an agent acting in the world. Then you have this sense of agency, and you go out the world and they're like, do this, all these pressures, you know. It's like everyone's planked and you're like, no, I'm gonna go here, I'm gonna make the world I want. Now you can't do much alone, but if you can then hook up with 10 other people with that agency and go, okay, we're gonna build this together. And then we're going to start making this intergenerational by having families. Then you start rebuilding a future. Mm-hmm. It's like when I say, like, you're surfing out in Cornwall, you get hit by an outside set and you're in the whitewash, you don't know what's up or down. You go to the bottom first. And once you feel the bottom, you spring up from the bottom to the top. You don't try to find the top because you'll just get caught in the whitewash.
I think
that metaphor of like going to the bottom, keeping fit, getting grounded, learning who you are, and then going out and approaching the world is probably the best course of action for anybody.
Dude, you're spot on. That's such good advice. And that's definitely something I think every young person should be trying and striving to do. And as a few ending questions, what's one action you want the viewers to take from this conversation, if it's on narcissism or something you've just said recently?
I will say this. I'm like, oh God, we've been talking a long time. Thanks for keeping an eye on the clock. It's just like me and coffee and you nodding. Yeah. So here's the thing. It's really hard for young people right now. I talk to a lot of young men. I have daughters. I talk to a lot of young women. Everybody is struggling. The world is not set up that saying, hey, dude, do this and it's going to work for you. If you do what the world tells you to do, you're screwed. Like it's just a nightmare. And I see young people get upset about it and they go, we're being screwed. And then they go, we're going to become socialists or something. I'm like, don't do that. I'm like, I promise. I know how you're being screwed. I understand how this works. That's not the solution. That's only going to make it worse. That's like buying the noose. But you're being screwed. It's going to be very hard for you to figure out why, because you don't understand economics and you don't understand business and taxes. And until you understand how all those economic systems work, you're never going to understand it. So young people, they get a story in their head. I'm like, if you're in London, go walk around the city of London and see if that looks different than the rest of the country, and then start asking yourself questions. So my thing is, it's really hard for you. You can have two choices. You can get upset and blame people for it, which is one option, and that will do you no good at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
It will, in fact, make your life worse.
Yeah.
Or you can say, God, it's too bad I got screwed, just like those guys did in World War II, or just like Keith's ancestors did when he went to that book in the British Military Museum in Edinburgh and looked up at every Campbell who was killed at the Battle of Somme. We could be gassed. We could be on the front lines of Ukraine right now if our maniacs in charge want to do that. So we're really not in that bad a shape. They just have a psychological war on us. We can beat a psychological war. How do we do that? We stay fit. We stay grounded. We learn how to control our emotions and ourselves. We build friendships and we build networks with people we trust. We support each other. We lift each other up. And then we start building lives and families around that and build a new network together. So you got to take just ownership of what's going on. But I want to say, like, you guys are just being screwed. Like, they have a thresher going through young people right now. And I see it. I mean, I just see it. And especially young men. That's the reality, but the solution is to take ownership, to get strong, to build. And I'm rambling, but you gave me the opening, so screw it. This is the mistake people make. They think they need to become a hero and then go face the world. It works the exact opposite way. You go face the world and you get your ass kicked many times. But in that process of getting your ass kicked, which you can relabel the labors of Hercules, you become a hero. You become strong by failing in the face of greater challenges. So you have to go for it. You have to take the hero's journey. You don't have a choice, because if you sit at home, you're dead. So you don't have, you're like, I don't want to do it. I'm scared. I'm like, I get it. I'm scared all the time. I don't want to do any more journeying. I've done it. Oh, I'm tired. But that's not how life works, especially in a dark time like now. You gotta just fucking go for it and just don't stop fucking going for it. And things are going to work, but you're going to get knocked on your ass. Because if you're not being knocked on your ass, God doesn't care enough about you to test you, you know? So if you get knocked on your ass, that means you're being tested. That means somebody's got a plan for you, that they're interested in you. If you're just fat and somebody gives you a bunch of money and sends you off to die, you assume they didn't have a play for you in a great rugby game of life. But if you get tested, that means somebody has a plan for greatness for you and they're strengthening it. But just keep going for it and don't ever stop.
Mm-hmm. Goosebumps.
God. Sorry for that. Dude, you made me do a Rambo speech. I didn't mean to.
That was so good, Keith. So good. Keith Campbell, ladies and gentlemen. Keith, I fucking love this. This was awesome.
Thanks, Jacob. I appreciate it.
Well, where can people go if they want to find your work? What are you currently working?
Oh, my work. You can look at wkeithcampbell.com. And I'm not working on a book other than a textbook right now, which isn't fun for anybody, but I write a Substack. So if anybody reads Substack, I have called Explorations and Personality. It's free.
Nice.
So I write that every week or two. That's kind of my intellectual connection. I'm on X, but I don't X very much.
Send me an email for your Substack. I'll leave in the show notes below and your website, of course, as well.
Okay.
Thank you for coming on the show.
Awesome.
Really appreciate it. I'd love to do a round two in the future, hopefully in person. And yeah, all the best.
Okay. Take care. See you next time.
If you've made it this far, you're likely not just a listener. You're ready to be the host. You felt that sense of intimacy and connection with our guest today, and you would like to get the same on your own show and start your own dream show. But you're worried about landing dream guests and all the complications and the mess that is often spoken about when starting your own podcast from scratch. You think starting a podcast requires a huge budget and a whole team, right? That is absolute nonsense. My Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint is the ultimate key to skipping the outdated advice and building a high quality, high impact show, even for under $100. It provides the proven strategies and AI templates that I use this day that you will be able to use to reclaim your time and creative control. And this is a strictly limited opportunity. Don't dilly-dally because there's limited spaces. We've already got one student, Rob, who's joined. That means there's only a couple more spaces to get the Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint course half price. And you need to act very, very fast because this is a limited offer and you're very, very early. So if you want to get the early bird discount like Rob has and get the results by watching the course that goes through the exact step-by-step blueprint that I use to this day to create these episodes that you've just watched and get the success and become Europe's fastest growing under 21 podcaster, and also join live weekly calls with me and use the AI templates and email templates that I use every single day to get the results and just get all my secrets without getting any of the mistakes and failures that I've made, then top link in the description is for you. And if you're ready to launch your own show and get personalized one-to-one help from me and copy my blueprint, which no other podcaster has shared, then I'll see you there. I'm rooting for you. Goodbye. Hope you enjoyed the episode too.